You're listening to a recorded talk from Greenbelt Festival.
Now, as we know, this session is all about Palestine. Just what can we do about that? I've got a message to share with you from the Greenbelt management. So Greenbelt Festival this year will include an intentional focus on Palestine in its programme. That's nothing new at Greenbelt. We've been platforming and spotlighting the Palestinian struggle for justice and equal rights since the 1980s. And we will continue to do so until Palestinians enjoy justice and equal rights. But what is different this year is the recent law, many of you will, I'm sure, know, proscribing Palestinian Action as a terrorist organisation. That said, whatever we might think of the proscription, it is law. And as a public event and a registered charity, we need to operate within it. So while we continue to hold utter outrage in our hearts and minds about what is unfolding before the world's eyes in Gaza and the West Bank, and while we have had and will continue to platform activists involved in non-violent direct action, Greenbelt must abide by the law as it is currently stands. We also do not want to make things any more difficult for our many Palestinian guests who are with us at the festival this year. We have shared this statement in advance with the artists and speakers who we are platforming at Greenbelt this year. We ask for your good grace in understanding this message. I'm going to hand over now to Chris from the Amos Trust. I would say if you want to find out more and have a conversation about Palestine, then do head to their stall around the site. I'm sure you'll see them around. Over to you.
Hi, it's great to see all of you here today. If you can't see it, so you're missing out because I think it is the best looking panel the festival has ever had. And that's just my presenter and Yara. We've got a fantastic panel today. There's not going to be any Q&A today, which some of you will be hugely relieved about, some of you will be annoyed about. There's going to be a chance to speak to Mohanad. He's speaking later on in the programme as well, so look in your notes, and he's going to be at the Embrace stall. We're going to be around the lighthouse and the caravan, that's Yara, Archimede and myself today and around there. So please, if you've got questions, come and find us or go to the book signing afterwards. Archimede's signing this fantastic book afterwards. If you haven't got a copy, there's 80 up there for sale. We don't want to take any back, so please buy them all straight away. I'm going to do a quick introduction and I'm going to get them to introduce themselves a bit more. Let me start with Yara. It's a wonderful pleasure to have you join us, Yara. Yara's a journalist from Gaza. It's worked for loads of different people. I'm not going to read the whole biography. It's in the programmes. You can read it all there and on site. But she became particularly famous for some lively discourse, I think is the right way of describing it, on television, where she put a couple of journalists in their place. So just be careful what you ask Yara over the weekend, okay?
Scary man.
Next up, we've got Mohanad. Mohanad is from the YMCA and YWCA in Jerusalem and the Bethlehem area and the Joint Advocacy Initiative, which is one of Embrace and Middle East partners. We work very closely with Embrace. He's over here with them this weekend. We've known Mohanad for many years. Fantastic programme. It's really wonderful to have you back at Greenbelt. It's your second time, is that
third,
right?
Third
time here. So it's an old hat. Yeah.
It's always good to be here, to be honest.
Fantastic. And then we've got the fantastic Archimede Al-Nawak, whose name I never quite pronounced properly, but one day I'll get it right.
No.
Go on, how's it pronounced?
It's Al-Nawak.
Anyway, Archimede is founder of We're Not Numbers, journalist from Gaza as well, trustee of Amos, speaker, and a close friend of Piers Morgan's.
Definitely not.
We will ask him more about the mighty Piers Morgan as the session goes along. But let's start off with what may be an easy question, maybe a really hard question. How are you? And Mohamed, can I start with you? How are you?
That's a wide question for me, yeah. Even though it's very short. I live in Palestine these days. And Palestine, it's everywhere these days. And maybe I'm pretty sure the people here knows a lot about what's happening. But in the past 22 months, and since I was born, I'm not feeling good because I travel a lot and I know how life looks like abroad. Like, I know what's the meaning of movement, freedom of speech, to be around, to live in a safe space. So I'm not feeling good today because of many reasons. I'm happy to be here among you and talking to you and that you're listening to us. That's very important. It makes me feel good. But if I look back to my home country, and I live actually there all my life, these days are really tough for Palestinians. And I think it should be tough for every human being who live in this globe. When we are looking at 2 million people being starved and they are facing all the different means of killing, this scene does not make me feel good. Whenever I eat, I think about the children. Whenever I wake up in the morning to wash my face, I think about the others who don't have any of this. So I think it's wrong if you are a human to feel good these days because other people are being punished and, being killed in all the different means. So I'm good to be here, but I'm not good in general, and I'm not feeling good.
Yeah, thank you. Yeah, can I ask you the same question?
Usually, Chris, when someone asks me how I am these days, I just like, I'm okay, and I start crying. I'm not gonna do that. It's actually a really difficult question. Within my network, my friends and my family, we actually don't ask, how are you these days? We ask, are you alive? Are you still there? This is the shift of asking questions to people in Gaza. I grew up my whole life in Gaza, so all of the people I've loved, the first I love you that I said, the first laugh I had, the first everything was in Gaza. I lost more than 90 members of my family, and that's 90, you heard it right. So honestly, there hasn't been one good day since the genocide started for me. I don't think one day I had a good night's sleep. I think I've had nightmares every single day since the genocide started. And I wish I can wake up and just think this is a whole huge nightmare. I'm so in denial that sometimes I feel like, yeah, I'll wake up one day and my best friend will pick up the phone. And so many times I reach out for my phone to call him, but he's not there, But, I hear a little kid here. So shout out to the parents for bringing the kid to a Palestine event. Political activist kid. I love it. My kid will be that. He's going to be an activist at the age of one. Just wait and see. good to be here at least.
And Ahmed.
Well, my answer won't be very different from Yara's. It is a really difficult question, and it is very difficult to describe how would a Palestinian feel during these days. But if you want to really know how we feel, imagine, Chris, that suddenly everything you care about is gone. That nearly everyone you know, that you love, that you care about is either dead or injured or displaced or even is starving. Yara said that she lost 90 of her family members. As for me, sometimes I ask ChatGPT, what do you know about Ahmed Al-Nawq? And ChatGPT responds as, he's the journalist who lost 21 members of his family. And for me, after that incident that took away the lives of my family, I stopped counting how many people I love who were killed in this genocide. So nearly everyone I know in Gaza was either killed or starved or injured. The house that I grew up in was bombed, demolished. The neighborhood that I grew up in destroyed. The university that I studied at destroyed. The mosque that I go to, destroyed. Everything I care about, everything I love, all my memories, all my past, everything is gone. How would you feel if you were in such a position? I think it's very difficult to describe it. But at the same time, I'm here with you, amazing people. Nearly 300-400 people came here to listen to us, to listen to the Palestinians. Very nice weather, amazing people, festivals, traveling, living in a quiet, lovely area. I have the freedom of expression. I have the freedom of movement. I could have the best of my life ever if the genocide did not happen in Gaza. And I live in the survivor's guilt and I'm torn. How do I feel? How should I feel? What should I do? It's like, you know, what's the word for the wama?
It's like a cycle that never ends. You're stuck in it.
And it's I believe this is how we feel. Like a few weeks ago, I had this dream when I was traveling and I saw myself like, you know, this windmill that crushes everything. And I was inside this mill that it crushes everything and grind everything. And I heard the voices of my family, the voices of the Palestinian people screaming and dying and the cities are destroyed and all of that. Like, it's in my head all the time. It's in my head. I can't stop thinking about Gaza. I can't stop thinking about Palestine. I can't stop thinking about myself, my future, my present, my family members, my nieces and nephews who were destroyed and killed. All of that happens in my head. And I am forced to live a normal life in this country. I'm forced to come to festivals like this. I'm forced to travel and speak about Palestine. While inside of me, inside of my mind, I'm torn apart. I'm devastated. I'm destroyed. But I have to pretend that I am strong. I am powerful. I am capable. That I need to go on. This is how I feel.
Thank you. So, yeah.
Just a quick add. I think when Ahmed, I've known Ahmed since I was 14. He was the first kind of mentor I had when I had like just started my activism in Gaza. So we used to go and help people, disadvantaged, the elderly. And when I heard the news of his family being killed, I expected Ahmed to disappear, like I did. When my family was killed, after a few months, I literally disappeared and people were like posting that I got killed by Israel. So I saw my own post being like, Rep Yara Eid. And I was like, bro, I'm still here. But I expected him to disappear like I did because it crushes you. When you see someone you love and they're no longer here and they got killed with the most advanced weapons, they got killed in a brutal way. It really messes with you. It messes you up, you know. But Ahmed did not stop. And whenever I think about Palestinian journalists, I think he's a prime example of that, of resilience, of never giving up despite how hard it gets. Honestly, I couldn't. He's stronger than me. I couldn't. I had a breakdown. I couldn't speak to anyone, even my mother. He continued. Since the genocide started, Ahmed did not take one day off. We're talking about almost 2 years of losing members of his family, of loved ones, of friends, of his homes, of his favorite places, day and day, every day. And he did not take one day of rest. So I applaud him for that. He's shy, he's blushing, but it's true.
Well, we're deeply privileged to have the three of you here. And we only feel the minutest amount of the pain which you feel. And that's bad enough. So we can't imagine what it's like and just that horrendous loss always. But thank you for being so eloquent about talking about it. I do want to spend a little bit of time talking about journalists. And in this, Ahmed, just before that, tell us a bit about Piers Morgan and your relationship with him, because everybody wants to know a little
Chris
bit more
is
about
obsessed it. With Piers. I don't know what it is.
I don't know what it is. Yeah. Actually, after I did this interview with Piers Morgan, and by the way, when Piers Morgan interviewed me, he was blocking me on Twitter. So he's not my friend. He's someone who hates me.
Like, because you accused him of being culpable for your family's death.
Yeah, I said when Israel killed my family, I said, and I saw how Piers is handling the Palestinians and how he's defending Israel and giving them the cover to continue the slaughter of the Palestinians. I said, Pierce, the blood of my family is in your hands. And then he blocked me and he called me an idiot. And he called me an idiot just a few days after Israel killed my family. And he kept blocking me for the whole time. And then he interviewed me. And he interviewed me while blocking me on Twitter. And he started the conversation with, why do you blame me for the murder of your family? And I blame you. And I blame all the Western media for the killing of my family and the killing of the Palestinian people. Because I know that Israel could not carry out a genocide without the cover from the mainstream media. Israel cares a lot of... It cares a lot about the West. The metropole of Israel is London and Washington. So Israel could not carry out a genocide without the Western support, without the Western weapons, without the Western media, without the Western diplomatic cover. And I know that. And from day one, the mainstream media in the West gave Israel everything it needs to carry out the genocide against the Palestinian people. And Piers Morgan was one of the pillars of this complicity of the mainstream media. So, after I did this interview with Piers Morgan, I would go everywhere and everyone would tell me that they saw this interview and they were happy about it, except my Palestinian friends. All of them hate it. All my Palestinian friends hated that interview I did with Piers Morgan. Why? And even our mutual friend a few days ago. And he said, I haven't seen him for 7 years or 8 years. And we were friends from Gaza and we never talked. And the moment he saw me, he told me, Ahmad, if you're not up to the task, don't do it. Don't do these interviews. And I said, why? He said, how could you listen to this man and not shout at him, yell at him, be angry with him? So all my Palestinian friends hated this interview because I wasn't angry enough. And I don't blame them. I don't blame them. We have all the right to be angry. We have all the right to be yelling and shouting. And we have the right to be angry.
Yes. And I think there's actually a saint now of Archimed for sitting in an interview with Piers Morgan and not punching his lights out. So I found it's a remarkable bit of nonviolence from you there. Tell us a bit about the story of Israel and journalists and why and their targeting of Palestinian journalists. It's a long history of it. Do you want to start and then I'll come to chip in?
Yeah, I don't mind. I mean, I refuse to go on Piers Morgan show because I am the angry Palestinian. I cannot. Yeah. Probably I would have punched him. Honestly, he deserves it.
Yeah.
So I guess I agree with Ahmed. I think, like, in a funny way, it's them idiots that made me famous. So it's the lack of professionalism within Western media that made us Palestinian journalists known in this genocide. You know, we've always existed. Palestinian journalists have always been there. I think it's the first time that the West has allowed us to speak. It's the first time, maybe they didn't even allow us, that we just screamed and our voices was heard by millions, if not, you know, billions on social media. Social media gave us what the Western media was taking from us years and years on end. So you asked me, Chris, about one of my interviews and you asked me the name of the presenter and I told you something like, I don't know names of people. I don't give power to idiots by knowing their name. And I actually don't know the name of this presenter. I was interviewed by Sky News and why I'm telling you the story because it literally summarizes the whole thing you need to know about Palestinian journalists. The woman interviewed me after I lost my family members. And I say woman because I do not regard her as a journalist. Because if she did 1% of what she needs to do as a journalist, she would have not asked me this question. She knows I lost many members of my immediate family. My cousins, my uncles, my aunts, their children, their grandchildren. Everyone I love in Gaza, basically. And she knew that I lost my best friend on the 7th of October, Ibrahim Lafi. I always talk about him. If you follow me on Instagram, you know, not a day goes without me remembering him. And, you know, I always say there are not enough tears to grieve him. And she had the audacity to ask me. Actually, she did two things. First, she said that, you know, I don't know, like 1,000 Israelis got killed on the 7th of October. And I don't know, around like 3,000 Palestinians have died. She had the audacity to say that Israelis get killed while Palestinians die. Yeah, guys, we just dropped dead of some disease that we never know. The disease is Israel. It's their weapons. It's their criminality. It's their, you know, literally their psychopaths. And that's how we have more than 60,000 Palestinians killed in the span of 2 years in a live stream genocide. And no one is able to stop them. So what happened in that interview and why it made me famous? Because people resonated with me. They felt like I was a human, just like them. I was not the Palestinian other. I was not someone who's Orientalist and somewhere, you know, far away. I was someone living in London who had family in Gaza, who studied here, who lives in the UK, who, you know, has British friends, who went to the British systems. So they resonated with me. They saw that I was a Palestinian and we're not terrorists and we're human and we're fashionable and we have very good food and we're funny and we have humor and we're just like you. And this is what the world has been deprived of. Our story. Israel has always, you know, dominated the narrative of they're terrorists. That's why we're killing them. You know, Bella Hadid go to Gaza, he'll be killed, you know? No, actually, she'd be complimented every single day. Like, we would love to have her in Gaza. So this concept of the Palestinian other, a lot of thinkers talk about it. And it's really, really important because that's how you vandalize anyone. That's how you, you know, paint them as the devil. That's how you paint them as someone that actually doesn't deserve to live because they're dangerous. We're not dangerous people. We're very lovely. How many of you have met Palestinians? Are you scared of them? Exactly. All of you have met Palestinians. We have amazing food. We have amazing music. We do dabka. We have kofia. We're stylish. We're funny. We're people at the end of the day. And I think this is what Western media lacks. And this answers your question in the sense, because they dehumanize us, that's why Israel keeps killing us. You know, we're talking about almost 260 journalists being killed only in this genocide, Chris. This is more than any journalists who have been killed in the history of conflicts. It's not a conflict, it's a genocide. But imagine that in the north of Gaza, the northern Gaza, where starvation and the forced famine is really bad there. People are dying from lack of food and water, and not just bombs. And we get a whole team of Al Jazeera journalists being obliterated in like this. Anas Sharif was one of the last journalists to be killed in Gaza. He was my colleague. I've talked to Anas a few weeks before he was killed. And the fact that he's no longer with us, the fact that his voice that became a symbol of Palestinian journalists, of Palestinian voice, is gone, just tells you enough about how powerful we are, how scared Israel is of us. Why would Israel bomb my best friend and kill him on the 7th of October? He was a 21-year-old Palestinian, honestly, guy. He wasn't even like 21, you know? That's a kid. And he was killed. You know why? Because he had a camera. He was my cameraman. I know for a fact, as a matter of fact, if I was in Gaza, I would have been killed from the first month. And that's why I have survivor's guilt too, because I know that I'm very privileged. And my family were deprived from life, from experiences. You know, God gave us the greatest gift, which is life, and they took it away from us. And I wish, Chris, you're interviewing me about love in Palestine, about our food, our culture, my memories with my loved ones. I wish I was a journalist that reports on the lives of Palestinians, not the death. I don't want to talk about the death of Palestinian no more, but I have to. So no more Palestinians get killed. I say that all these Palestinian journalists have been killed so we can live. And that's why I don't have the privilege of giving up. That's why I continue to wake up every single day, no matter how depressed or tired or exhausted, and I keep talking about Palestine. And that's why you are here, because you believe in the existence of Palestinians. You believe that we're human just like you and we should live. And I urge you, as a matter of fact, if you do care, if you're a human with a good heart, to continue talking about us. If you're tired, just remember, Mohannad said, this has been his whole life. It's been my whole life. It's been Ahmed's whole life. I don't remember old good days. We've always been under occupation. We've always been killed. We've always been traumatized. I've been in therapy for the last 8 years, and it's not because of, you know, my dating life. It's because of Israel. That tells you enough.
Yeah, thank you. Ahmed, is there anything you want to add to that, or shall I come back to you in a few minutes? Thank you, Yair, very much. Mahanad, I want to come to you if that's okay.
Yeah.
You're from the West Bank. The West Bank's even more underreported. I wondered if you could tell us maybe a couple of stories about what the situation is like in the West Bank now from there.
Yeah, I mean, in the West Bank, also it's bad as Gaza, I would say. I mean, I understand what's happening in Gaza and all the eyes on Gaza, but that also was used by the Israeli army to also do their work in the West Bank. Since the beginning of the war, like since October 7 exactly, Israelis replaced hundreds and hundreds of iron gates around the cities, you know, the Palestinian cities. So people were locked for almost 1 or 2 months, you know, inside the cities. We are not able to go out. And we thought that's emergency situation and it will be reopened. But until today, they are replacing more and more gates around the city. So if you ask me about it, I feel like I'm living in a jail. Like in Bethlehem, for example, 80% of the borders of the city are surrounded by wall. So you can't actually access, you know, to the other cities. And the rest of it, either by fences or settlements or gates. So if you wake up in the morning, you want to go somewhere, you will face many checkpoints, like thousands of checkpoints and gates. And Israel is harassing Palestinians as if it's collective punishment of what happened in Gaza. So they armed a lot of settlers. They pushed more soldiers and army, and they put more restrictions on Palestinians in the West Bank. So it's not safe at all for us, you know, to move inside the West Bank. What we are witnessing is movement like restrictions, so we are not moving. Settlers attacks, you know, there is more than 30,000 Israeli settlers got armed by the government, and they were unleashed, you know, in the West Bank. So if you look at all the villages, you know, around Ramallah, around the city of Bethlehem, near Jericho, these small communities are being attacked on a daily basis. And these settlers, they are really brainwashed, and they are more scary than the Israeli army because they have no morals. They look at Palestinians as below level, and they are brainwashed. So you think you are talking to a human being like you, and then you discover he just can put the gun in your eyes and shoot you. Direct. And that happened. And if you look at the social media, you will see that on Instagram. And now it's more and more taking the lands from the Palestinians. And we feel that, or we're witnessing that, there is a plan for Israelis to establish more and more settlements in the West Bank to annex more and more lands. Now there is like a project called the Greatest Jerusalem or a Greater Jerusalem, where it will, you know, split or like isolate the West Bank from each other. So Hebron and Bethlehem will be one side. The rest of the West Bank will be in another side, and we are separated. I also witnessing apartheid. You know, there's many roads that I can't drive. Like if my family carrying a different ID, they will take a different road. I will take, you know, a different road. Soldiers are there on this checkpoint. They are very rude to Palestinians. And it seems like they are selecting this kind of soldiers who can punish Palestinians. So if you go to your work in the morning, you have to stay in the queue for 3 or 4 hours to cross from Bethlehem to Ramallah. More than 1,000 people got killed recently in the West Bank. Hundreds of houses and cars and the property, you know, got burned by the Israeli settlers. Thousands and thousands of olive trees and other crops, you know, got destroyed by the bulldozers and by the settlers. A lot of arrestment for children and people. Like during the last 22 months, more than 10,000 people, Palestinians, they were detained and arrested in the Israeli jails. Many of my friends who were released recently, you know, if you are in the Israeli jails these days, there is no food, no blankets, no water to shower. They let the dogs come inside the jail and attack and beat, you know, the prisoners. They put a lot of people inside. They are not allowed to go out. All the ministries and people in the government stand and threatening Palestinians. During the raids, you know, they come to the cities to arrest people. They are more aggressive, like my refugee camp where I live. The other night they came, they collected or they arrested, detained 45 Palestinians from my camp, young people.
They gathered them in the Hesha refugee camp.
They gathered them in one of the cultural centers. They destroyed everything, make a space, you know, just blind them, handcuff them, put them in one room and start to beating up, you know, until 6 a.m. And then they just throw them and they took a selfie with it. You know, 45 young Palestinian behind the captain, and he took a selfie and he just led them, you know, outside in the cold, and he took his military vehicles and they left. So we don't feel safe. You know, there's 45,000 displaced Palestinians in the north of the West Bank, in Tul Karem, in Jenin. And Ahmed was talking about that his family and his, you know, like his neighborhood was destroyed. We are also talking about the same in the West Bank. In these three refugee camps, there is no memories left for people. Like the street, the neighborhood, the camp, the shops that you used to know. Now people going back to that neighborhood, there is nothing. So there is no memories for them. And a lot of them being killed and now displaced. So they are living in shelters outside the camp. I don't think there is a lot of people talking about this incident in the West Bank. You know, all the eyes, yes, in Gaza, but in the West Bank, it's also horrible. And we are feeling that we will be displaced at some point. So all in all, I feel like I am living in a jail in the West Bank. And in any moment, you could be killed or injured or arrested. And every day we are under this pressure.
Thank you for that. The South Hebron Hills is an area which we know very, very well.
Yeah.
Do you want to just say a little bit about what's going on there at the moment, and particularly about the death of Aldo a couple of weeks
ago? You know, these communities there, they are living there since tens and hundreds of years. They have been living there. And there is a big attack from the Israeli settlers to take this area. So there are always harassment, punishment, attacks by the Israeli settlers. And since the war started 22 months ago, it became more severe, and they want to evacuate or displace, you know, forcibly displace these communities. And they are very simple people. They are like, you know, just people who are living with their sheep, with their very simple life. And they are being attacked severely by the Israeli settlers on an attempt to displace them out. Recently, there was a guy who was killed. He's activist, and he participated in the famous film about Palestine. But that's also have been happening all the time. 2 weeks ago, I was in a visit for H1, H2, Hebron, you know, area, in like just with a group of people who are coming. To go to that area, you know, like Shuhada Street and the Ibrahimi Mosque, you know, to get in, you need to go through the rolling gates, and there are soldiers. This used to be all the years before, but today you are not allowed to bring food, bread, milk. You will be checked, you will be punished, you will be insulted, you know, by the Israeli soldiers. And many times there is a lot of Palestinians who got injured in that area. If you want to go to the mosque to pray, you are not allowed. You have to go like a different route, which is far away for all people to go to pray. I saw a lot of barriers, and Palestinians, they are only having a very like small or narrow path for them to walk, while at the same street, there's a very wide road for the settlers to walk. I also witnessed a soldier shouting on a little girl who's standing in the front of her house, just like shouting at her to go in. So there is hundreds of Palestinians living in that area, but they are not allowed to bring food or gas or any needs, basic needs for them to give it to their neighborhood. And they are not allowed to stand in the front of their house. They are not allowed to stand on the window. All the windows are closed by fences and bars because settlers keep attacking the Palestinians. So this is not, I mean, like if you ask someone who lives there in the last 22 months, I think he preferred to die. Because Palestinians, they will not leave their home. Like that's a fundamental thing in the way how we think. So if you live with your children for 22 months in your house and you are not allowed to access outside, and you are not allowed to bring gas or food, which kind of life is this? And you are under the threat of the Israeli settlers 24/7. They shoot, they stone the houses. They throw cocktail Molotov on the families. They physically attack and punish the children. So I think they are very traumatized and locked in these houses, but they are still insist to stay in these neighborhoods and in the houses. So, I mean, that's the scene in the West Bank, and that's one of the examples. But that's also applying on many other villages, you know, where our Palestinians are being attacked by the settlers.
Thank you.
Yeah.
I'm going to come to Ahmed, if that's okay. Just very quickly. Yeah.
For people who don't know about the West Bank and Gaza, yeah, you just need to know that in Gaza, we don't have settlers, which is really different from the West Bank experience. A lot of Gazans have never met an Israeli soldier till this genocide. We had no Israeli presence on the ground. It was always kind of like you know, the video games of like just bombs dropping. And I think this is crucial to differentiate the realities between yep. Gaza and the West Bank, just okay. for the people who don't know.
Yeah, thank you. Ahmed, I'd just like you to say a little bit about this book. I'll let you hold the copy of it. And particularly the people who've contributed to that, the young journalists. And just tell us a little bit about them and the book.
Before I talk about the book, I want to comment on what Yara and Mohammed were saying. So Yara was talking about the plight of the Palestinian journalists in Gaza and how they have been systematically destroyed and obliterated and killed in hundreds. And Mohammed was talking about the West Bank and how Israel is tightening the screws on the West Bank. I want to say that all of this is happening by design. It is calculated. It is designed. And the purpose of all of that is the purpose of the occupation and what they have been doing in the past 77 years. They want to completely destroy the Palestinian people. They want to completely ethnically cleanse the Palestinian people from Palestine. They're doing it in steroids in the Gaza Strip by killing the Palestinians en masse, and they're doing it in the West Bank slowly. All of this is happening because Israel wants to ethnically cleanse the Palestinians from Gaza and the West Bank. And when they're done with Gaza, they will go to the West Bank. They will go to the Palestinians in 48 and go on and so on, unless we stop them. Yes.
Can I speak? Yeah. Now we hear more about the greater Israel, which will target Syria and Lebanon. And there was a settlement being established in Syria, on Syrian ground, like recently. So we hear more voices about the greater Israel, which will target Jordan and Lebanon and Syria, you know, all the way until Iraq. That's, I have been hearing this recently, that they want to implement this Zionist project for Israel to be widen, you know, in the Arab countries, not only in Palestine.
Yes, of course. They have always been talking about the greater Israel, which will take all of historic Palestine, part of Egypt, part of Saudi Arabia, part of Kuwait, part of Iraq, yeah. and all of Lebanon and Syria. And I think they will do it, because why not? Like, they're having this expansionist settler mentality. If they can take more lands, then why not? If they can take Gaza, then why not? Who is preventing them from taking more lands, more of other Arab countries? And when they're done and taking all these Arab countries, then they will come to you. I don't know what will happen here.
That's what I was going to say.
But who prevents them?
Yeah.
If they are all powerful, if they have all the impunity, if they can behave above the laws, then why not?
The question, which is a common, which we would get back from that normally, is that's not the whole of Israel. That's the government and its certain groups in Israel.
Yeah, it just happens that this group is the Netanyahu, the most powerful man in the country, and some ministers of his government. That doesn't make any sense. This represents most of the settler mentality in Palestine.
Zionist,
it represents all of them, unfortunately. And not only the Israelis, but also some Christian Zionists in America and in the West and in Europe. These people, when they look at us, at me and Mohammed and Yara, they don't see us as equal human beings. They see us as like parasites, like less of a human beings. And they see of Israel as more superior than us. So unfortunately, if we do not stop them, they will continue and they will go on and on and on. And they have crossed all the limits. They have pushed the boundaries of what is acceptable in Palestine. And if we let them do it, they will expand and go on and on and on. And we should not wait until they come to us here in the West. You should not wait until they come to you. You should stop, because the Palestinians are human beings and they deserve to be protected. They deserve to live like a human beings. And Israel is killing us, is destroying us, is doing all of this evil against us by your weapons, by your votes, with support of your diplomats, with support of your government, with support of your politicians. So this has to stop.
Also, don't care. How many of you know Rachel Corrie?
Yeah?
If you don't know her, she's an American activist that was killed by a bulldozer in Gaza. In front of my friend's house, actually. He is one of the witnesses to the Hague case. So they don't even care about you. They don't care about the West. They don't care about Americans. They don't care about, you know, Jewish people. You know, they're actually really anti-Semitic. Israelis are literally the most anti-Semitic people that were invented. And I say this and I can fight you on it, because if you are saying anything against Israel, you're a self-hating Jew, or you are a disgrace to Judaism, or you're not really a Jewish person. Like, what? Who are you, son of God, to tell me if I'm a good Jew or not? And that's what I'm saying. Like, a lot of Palestinians get killed even if they have dual nationality. A lot of non-Palestinians, journalists or activists who come to Palestine, get killed, get injured. They don't care. There's literally no one that scares them. They feel like the whole world is just under them, and they're the superior ones. And I really agree with Ahmed. I even wrote about it. I always tell my mom, and my mom is like, Yara, please stop telling me this. This is scaring me. She asks for my opinion, guys. And I'm always right, suddenly, in politics only.
You sound like my daughter.
But, you know, they are going to come after all of us. Honestly, what would stop them? Like, look at what happened just in the genocide. They've bombed Egypt at the border. They killed Egyptian soldiers. And then Egyptian government said, oh, it was by mistake. Yeah, I sent a rocket by mistake. You know, I spilled coffee by mistake. I don't send a rocket by mistake. And then they do the same thing in Syria. They're already doing stuff to control Jordan. So why would they not control us here? We hear a lot about, like, oh, the Muslims are taking over the UK. Trust me, it's going to be Israel. And I'm always right.
You do sound like my daughter.
Yeah. And I want to be quoted on this. I don't mind.
He's always right.
When Israel is done killing all the Palestinians in Gaza, or Palestinian journalists in Gaza, they will come to Palestinian journalists outside of Gaza. Mm-hmm. They will come to people like Yara and me. And they will come for us.
I see it.
They will come for us. Mm-hmm. And they will pretend that, well, Yara and I have always been critical of Hamas, by the way. But Israel will say that we are Hamas members.
Sympathize.
They will do it. And they will come for us. They will hurt with us. They will hurt us. And our government, the British government, will not say a word about it. It will be acceptable. And then when they're done with the Palestinian journalist outside Palestine, they will come to other non-Palestinian journalists. And they will say that they are Hamas sympathizers or terrorist sympathizers, and they will come for them. And your government will not say a word about it because they are controlled by these freaks. And I mean it. And then they will come to you, and then they will come to more and more and more people unless they are stopped. And they must be stopped.
Okay, so this brings us on to what do we as activists need to be doing to take the next steps forward? And what would you encourage us to, maybe doing more of the same and maybe other things? What sort of stuff would you want to encourage us today to go from here and do to try to preserve and to end what's happening, to preserve Palestinian, in order to pursue Palestinian rights and an end to the genocide? What would you encourage us to do?
Well, right now I can see that there is a huge sense of helplessness. Among the Palestinian movement, among the peace and justice movement here in the UK, people are saying that we have been protesting for 22 months and the war did not stop, the genocide did not stop. We have been calling out, we have been protesting, we have been writing, we have been screaming, we have been doing everything in our power. And that did not end the genocide. And so many people think that it's a hopeless case. Palestine will never be free. The Zionists will never stop. But I want to tell you, please do not stop. Because the moment we stop protesting, the moment we stop speaking up, the moment we stop sharing stories of the Palestinian in social media, on that moment, we will be defeated. As long as we are fighting, we are not defeated. And I am telling you, Israel is winning the military war. Israel is winning on the ground.
Of course.
They have completely destroyed all of Gaza. They have been destroying the West Bank. They will win on the ground because they are superior power. They have all the weapons they need. They have all the power they want. But on the long run, Israel will not win. As long as we are speaking up, they will not win. In 10 years or 20 years, the Israelis will be ashamed of calling them Israelis. Do you know why? Because the Palestinian journalists took it upon themselves to record, to write, to show the world what's happening in Palestine, to show the world what the Israelis are doing to the Palestinian children and women and men in Gaza. And that Israel cannot erase from the history books. History books are being written, and it is being written that Israel is committing a genocide, a brutal, unethical genocide against the impoverished Palestinian people. That is being written. And when the world sees it, when the entire humanity sees and finally realizes what Israel has done to the Palestinian people, the reputation of Israel will never be recovered. They will never recover their reputation. And Israel could not continue. They could not carry on a genocide after genocide without their reputation, without their image, especially here in the West. So what you are doing here is very important. What you are about to do is very important. Do not be hopeless. Mm-hmm. Do not stop protesting. Do not stop speaking up on Palestine. And sometimes level up your action for Palestine. Yeah. Level up your action. Every action you have to do, it has to be legal, by the way. Do not do something illegal. Do not do something illegal, because they will use it against you to crush you. So you'll have to be smart about it. Mm-hmm. You'll have to be smart, but you have to continue. You'll have to continue. We cannot stop. We cannot afford to stop. The Palestinian people depend on you. They are watching you. They're listening to you. They're seeing your pictures. They're seeing what you're doing in Palestine. And gives them a huge boost to continue being resilient in Palestine. So whatever you do, continue. If you are a lawyer, use your expertise to defend the Palestinian people. If you are an artist, write about Palestine, draw for Palestine. Whatever you have an expertise in, use it for Palestine. Because when you use it for Palestine, you use it for yourself. You're using it for yourself because you are a human. And we humans, we should side with each other. We should be holding each other's hands. We should continue fighting for each other. Thank you.
Mohammed, would you like to add anything to that at all?
Yeah, I just want to add to what Ahmed was saying, but I disagree with something that he said, which is Israel did not win by killing 60,000 people. They lost. And you can't say about someone who won the war by killing the people and destroying their homes. I think Israel is now in the bottom. Like, they lost morals, they lost their reputation, they lost their respect, they lost their narrative, they lost their history. Like, no one now look around and say, oh, Israel, we love Israel because it's democracy or because they are developed and like modern. No, Israel has lost in all the means. If you think you are winning by killing children or starving 2 million people, this is a shame. Like, this is the big loss, you know? You can't make up anything else. But this moment and this month about starving the people and killing 20,000 children, this is shame. And it will carry and it will keep stick to you all the way until, you know, hundred and hundred of years. So I see Israel losing. And our rules now is to unfold and expose, you know, the action of Israel, to talk about it and to share it. Maybe when you are demonstrating or protesting in the street, you don't feel or you didn't think this is making a pressure, you know, on the government. But I see it, it's making a big pressure, you know. When I see the protest in London or when I see people taking action or boycotting Israel, in the States the same, in many other countries, European countries, they are taking action for Palestine. First of all, it gives us hope as Palestinians. We need it. We need to see that there is people who still believe in our cause and people are standing for the children. So that support us and support the people of Gaza. And there is indirect impact happens. All of the people who participate in this protest, they donate for Palestine. And it's inspire us to take action and to make projects and to help the Palestinians. So this dialogue or like all of these movements, you know, even though I wish it's more organized, like, you know, in the UK, in Europe, in America, we were working in an initiative, how we can bring all this protest one day together, you know, so we can like really shout, you know, in all the globe about what's happening in Palestine. So as Ahmed said, I keep saying that you keep protesting, keep taking action. You know, here, like there is the stand of embrace. You can go. We have started the campaign for children detention. You can sign there, you can take the bundle and you can take action here in Greenbelt. You can donate for Palestine, you can donate for olive trees. There is many initiatives where, as a person on personal level, you can take it and keep sharing the story. And we will keep going on this. And we are very sure that it's a very long term, you know, battle. You know, like it will not change tomorrow or in 1 year or in 2 years. And all of these people who are got killed, their blood or their bodies will not go for free. It's a part, you know, of this way of liberation of Palestine. Oh, and also liberating ourselves, not only Palestinians. Because I don't think you should be accepted or like you should be okay with what's your government doing. I mean, our children are being killed by your money and by the American people money. Like your government sent all the bombs. And if you are a human, you should not accept this. Like you shouldn't go to bed while you are feeling good when your government is participating in starving the children in Gaza. So every single move or action makes difference, but it's a very long, you know, like term and long way for us to walk, you know, together. But I see the whole system of Israel is collapsing. I see it. Like this will never go more than this. You know, 60,000 people got killed, starving 2 million, torturing people in all the means, arresting 10,000 people, most of them are children. Like, what is this? You know, like, who would accept it? Like, this is wrong. And the wrong will never keep going, you know, for farther than this. Maybe, yes, a little bit more, but all this will collapse at some point. So it's our choice today if we want to participate in making this system collapse or not. And it's a human question. It's about humanity and what would you do for the children in another country. Thank you.
I'm just going to ask for a quick show of hands. Who's been on the protests and done some sort of activism for Palestine here?
Bravo, guys.
If you haven't, we get people who sound a bit nervous or scared of going them. Honestly, they're the best protests. They're a lot more fun. I go on some of the environmental protests and they're really quiet and boring. The Palestine ones are really lively. You get loads of music. You have a real laugh with people. So come and join us. Come and join us. And do creative things. Think about ways outside the box. If you'd asked us 3 years ago, and if you'd spoken to ourselves, Embrace, you'd spoken to PSC, any other groups involved in advocacy and campaigning, loads of people you can name, sorry, it's not an exhaustive list. We would have gone, wow, to have the numbers involved, to see that the majority of the people in the UK support Palestine, think there's fundamental things. There's a massive change, and we're making huge progress. Just we'd obviously give it all up for there to be no deaths in a second. But we really are making progress. So when we do hear people say, oh, I feel hopeless, I feel helpless, actually, we are winning in that battle. We may not be winning on the ground, but we're winning in that battle. Yara. Yeah.
I think I agree with what Ahmed and Mohammed said. And I think Ahmed's point was they're winning, not winning per se, but like military wise, if we're looking just at facts, obviously they have a nuclear army. Obviously Palestine doesn't have an army. So on a just very political factual point, yes, the numbers are obviously, you know, like you cannot compare the two sides. There's an oppressor and oppressed. But I'm going to talk about, you know, what they said. I agree with them, but I have a problem with something called selective activism. I have a problem with activism that's trendy, activism that's cool to be part of. Palestine is not a cool issue. I mean, yeah, we're cool people, but it's not a cool issue. It's a genocide. It's a live stream genocide. Your actions will either stop a genocide or enable Israel to kill more children. You know the whole lie that they spread at the beginning of like beheading babies, you know? They've done it in Gaza. Everything they denied at the start, like, we would never bomb a hospital. Come on, who do you think we are? They literally now talk openly about it. When they assassinated Anas al-Sharif, they said he was part of Hamas. And I went on Channel 4, and one of the interviewees, he asked me, he said, but you know, Israel says that he was part of Hamas. And my answer to him was, you work for Channel 4. You have colleagues in Gaza. They've been called Hamas sympathizers. Do you think your colleagues are Hamas? He was stunned to speak. Because anyone initially. Right now, we're a room full of Hamas sympathizers. Like, I'm sorry to say it, but honestly, this is how they see anyone who supports Palestine. And if you really think about it, Hamas is not a new, like, it's new. It's not a very, you know, like, Hamas was not always there. It's a new phenomenon. It's a political ideology, whatever they, you know. Palestine is the issue. It's not Hamas. It's not religion. It's not Islam. It's not Judaism. It is Palestine. Palestine is not a religious issue. It's an issue of someone who's literally a psychopath that believes that they're better than us, and thus they have the right to my backyard. And Israel gets summarized in one sentence of that settler, Yaqub, his name or whatever, who said to Mun al-Kurd, my friend, Palestinian activist from Jerusalem, from Hay Sheikh Jarrah neighborhood, he said, Muna, if I don't steal it, someone else will. That's the mentality of Zionists, that they can steal whatever they want. Thieves, literally thieves. I've never stolen a pen in my life. How can you be so morally okay with stealing not only houses, homes, memories, but literally actual lives? And I always say this in my interviews when we talk about the military and what they do, the brutality of it. And it goes back to actually what the British did in the British Mandate. You know, the Israeli torture weapons, the torture techniques, they're not invented by Israelis. Some of them, yes, but some of them were practiced by the British officials in British Mandate Palestine. And that's shameful. That's shameful. And I know that you do not, like, stand with that. I know you're here today in a festival for music, like, who the hell wants to talk about war and dead people? But you're here because you care. Because inside you, there is something good. And that's why I hate selective activism. Palestine is not a trend. We've been dying since before even 1948. We've been dying by the British as well. And, you know, honestly, you are complicit if you're not speaking up, because your tax money is funding genocide. Go Google how much the British government sends to Israel, how British drones are flying over Gaza. For me, that makes me sick to my stomach. I don't want to work in this country and give my money to kill my cousins, you know? But you're contributing if you're silent. And that's why we need the protests. But, you know, I love whoever is wearing a kufiya, shout out to you. And I love that you do. And I don't mean it in any bad way or rude way, but wearing a kufiya is not enough. You know, it's good. Yes, show support. You know, the other day, I did this fun thing where I counted how many people that wore a kufiya and were on the trains in the tube. And there were 7 in one night. That was really good. So shout out to London and people who wear kufiyas. But you need to do more. You need to protest. You need to read. You need to do what my friend Enrica did. Shout out to her. She came to me. She's this Italian lady, doctor. And she told me, you know, she's very educated, but doesn't know enough about Palestine. She literally just told me, can you give me one class on Palestine? Because, you know, I know it's bad what's happening. I know people are dying. I know I have to do something, but I don't know enough. You know, when my Italian friends ask me, like, why do you support Palestine? Sometimes I don't know what to say. And I told her, ask no more. I'm working on a presentation for her, and it's an interactive one. And I have the maps, and I'm actually a nerd, so I'm doing a really good presentation. So ask your Palestinian friends for more information on Palestine. Watch Palestinian movies. We have so much to offer. You know the people? No one can piss me off as much as someone who likes coriander and them people who say, it's too complicated. You know, I cannot make up my mind. I need to know more. Then know more. There are resources. There are people. You know, Palestinians are everywhere. We're in the diaspora. Yes, not many of us. But just go on Instagram and watch some interviews. Watch a movie if you don't like to talk about politics. Just see how life is there. Don't do selective activism. Don't just go to protest. No. Convince your mates that Palestine is a genocide, what's happening there. You know, speak up. Don't be scared. Be loud. Be proud. Be Palestinian with us. And when I become president, I might give you passports. I might.
I'm going to move us on because we're kind of officially out of time, but we're going to overrun by a few minutes, if that's okay. And I'm going to just ask each of you a kind of final question. Ahmed, I'm going to ask you about the book, because you can't just sit there, because all the writers from Women Not Numbers are going to be really annoyed if you don't talk about them in the book. So say something about this. Yeah. It's called We Are Not Numbers. Ahmed's going to be signing it in the bookshop straight after this at 1:30.
So this is not my book, just to be clear. This is a book of more than 59 Palestinian young writers from Gaza who have been writing these stories, their personal stories, for the past 10 years. It is a collection of stories written by young people. Most of them are younger than me. They're writing about their life under occupation, under blockade, under siege, during the March of Return, during previous military offenses in Gaza, even during the genocide. They have been writing their heart out for you to read their stories. Many of them, many of our writers who contributed in this book have been killed. Many of them were killed with all of their family members. Many of them were displaced. Many of them lost their homes. Many of them were displaced many, many, many times. But they continued to write even during the genocide, even under the bombardment of Gaza. And they have been writing their stories for you in English. And this is a very important book. It's a bestseller now in the UK. It's a bestseller
sold,
in Ireland.
15,000 copies, something like that?
I don't know. I don't know.
You gave up after 10 years.
I know it's more than 10,000 copies were sold. Yeah, it is translated into Italian. It is available in Italy. We are translating it now to Japanese. So it will be available in Japan soon. It will be available in North America in a week from now. It's doing very well, but it's a very, very powerful book. Very powerful collection of stories. You need to get yourself a copy, and you need to buy another copy and gift it to one of your friends. The royalties of this book will go directly to our writers in Gaza, who have been writing and sharing their news from under their genocide for you. So please get yourself a copy, and I will be signing it if you want. At one.
And guys, highly recommend. Yeah.
By the way, she's one of our writers.
Yeah. it is a remarkable
book.
Not
in the book.
Not in the book.
Yeah, no. So don't worry.
Yeah. It's a remarkable book. It's one of those books you pick up, you think you're going to read one story, you read three, and you just kind of, they're just remarkable. Human stories, not just of genocide, but stories of humanity, beautiful stories, beautiful poems, and real tragedy as well. All caught here. We partner with We're Not Numbers. Come and see us at Amos. If you want to support that, we give grants through We're Not Numbers to pay for stories now in Gaza so people earn an income from this. It's really, really important. So please support that. I'm going to go to Mohamed next. Tell us a little bit, what are you going to talk about later on today? What are you going to fill people in about?
I will be talking on Sunday.
Sunday, yep.
About also life under occupation, about my project, the Olive Tree Campaign. It's a very important project where we help Palestinian farmers to maintain their lands in the West Bank. Now there is a big campaign from Israel against the farmers and the villages and the very ordinary and simple farmers who lives in these villages. So last year we planted 90,000 olive trees for them among all the West Bank. And we moved from 47,000 to 90,000 olive trees because a lot of people, and that's actually the outcome of protesting and taking action and learning about Palestine. And this year also we are trying to target or to reach to a good number of olive trees so we can help the farmers maintaining and cultivating. More than 400,000 Palestinians, they are not working in Israel now, and they went to farming in the West Bank. That's why the request also by the farmers getting more and more, and the demand getting more and more. So we need more olive trees. So please go to Embrace Stand. There will be more information about the project. I would appreciate if you can help the farmers also with olive trees.
And they make great Christmas presents as well, don't they?
Yes.
So if you want to gift an olive tree at Christmas, it's a wonderful campaign.
Yeah.
We wish we'd thought of it first. but no, it's just a wonderful campaign. So please do support that with Embrace. Yeah. Now, I really am aware of time because they're going to start getting nervous about in about 2 minutes' time. You've got a couple of poems which you'd like to share with us, if that's okay, if I could ask you to read
them. I'm sorry, guys. If you feel like you need to go, I won't be offended. But I think I like to do many things. I get bored of just doing one thing. So sometimes I'm an artist, sometimes I'm a dancer, horrible one. Sometimes I'm a journalist, sometimes I just don't want to do anything. And I talked to this Palestinian lady, her name is Shams, and she is literally a sunshine. Shams means sunshine in Arabic. And she told me, because I always read poetry and I always resonated with it, I used to perform a lot of spoken word within Palestine. That's how I was competing nationally for poetry. And that's how actually as a kid I kept sane by living under occupation. I lived there for 16, 17 years of my life in Gaza, in a refugee camp. So life was tough. So I was just a nerd, and I was telling Ahmed how my gifts from my parents were always books, poetry books, literature about Palestine, you know, resistance literature and stuff like that. So I was a really nerdy kid. And the first poem, I don't know if it's a poem, it's just some thoughts that I wrote one day. I was feeling really, really sad after someone of my friends got killed. And I wrote, it's called, "Where Do They Go? All of my loved ones, after they leave me, after they leave us, after they leave their daughters, their sons, their lovers, where do they all go? Sometimes I wonder. I sit there and wonder if there is a little heaven within the heavens called Gaza, and it's full of my people, journalists, teachers, doctors, artists, mothers, fathers, sisters and brothers, and many, many lovers. Do they have the same names? Are they happy? Do they see us? Where do they all go? Do they feel us? Do they see our tears? Do they hear our screams? Do they feel our pain? Do they see their mothers holding them and trying to be so strong? Do they hear our silent weeps? Do they see our nightmares? Can they see that we're hungry? Do they have food? Can they drink what they want? Sometimes I wonder if they know that they're not just numbers, that they are remembered by the hundreds, by the thousands, by the millions. Sometimes I wonder if my prayers reach them, and if they do, do they send some back to us? Sometimes I wonder if there's a little heaven called Gaza within all the heavens, and everyone knows that it only welcomes the bravest of the bravest. Thank you.
Thank you.
This is the second time I've ever performed my just words. I don't know if it's poetry. It's called Shams, which means sunshine in Arabic. And our children, their eyes sparkle, not full of tears, but full of dreams that they couldn't reach. And if you look deep into our children's eyes, you will see the dreams that they've never achieved, lingering and waiting for a day that never comes. And if you look deep into our children's hearts, you will see body parts of their loved ones, or even their own. And if you look deep into our children's souls, you will see wounds that are beyond repair, bloody with despair. And if you look deep into our children's minds, you'll hear stories that scar from afar. And when you hold the flesh of another child, you'll think of your own. But have you lost your mind? Have you lost your mind like that lady who's abandoned in Jabalia refugee camp? She never traveled, but thinks the world is vast. She has a baby. She had her after 15 years of making love and not succeeding. She had her after 355 needle injections into her body. She had her after 4,500 tears that rolled on her cheeks. Every night before she sleeps, she weeps. Her baby was called Shams, which means sunshine in Arabic. It's beautiful, don't you think? To have your own sunshine after 15 cold years, and then there he is, Alon Skokagyo. And by the way, I don't know if this is how you pronounce his name. I said I don't give power to these who are martyrs. He shot her 15 times. Every shot represented a year her mother was trying to conceive. Every shot was more painful than the 355 needles combined. And if you look deep, you will see Shams's mother bleeding on the sidewalk, holding her baby, her bloody baby. That once was a sunshine. Covered in blood, she lost her mind. She gasps, "Is this my Shams? Is this my child? Is this my child? Is this my sunshine?"
Thank you. We're going to have to finish now. Thank you so much, Mohanad. Thank you so much, Yara. Thank you so much, Ahmed. As has been mentioned, you can find Mohanad on the Embrace stall. You can find Yara and Ahmed around today by the caravan or over by the lighthouse. If you haven't seen the lighthouse, if you haven't asked about it yet, come and find the Amos team. We're going to be around at various points. It's based on a lighthouse in Gaza Harbour, which was destroyed, and it's made by an artist called Sharif Sahan. Come and talk to us about that, and talk to us about the amazing people we're working with in Gaza. We're working with about 10 different projects in Gaza, doing incredible work. Come and chat to us about that. But a huge thank you to all of you. It's been our privilege to have you here today. Thank you.
Thanks so much for listening to this recorded talk. Explore our full Greenbelt Festival Talks archive with almost 20 years of recorded talks and podcasts. For free at greenbelt.org.uk/talks.